It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
Hola, bola. Welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show. It is 10 o'clock. Actually, to be precise, it's 5 minutes after 10. 203-333-9422 is our number. And I have to tell you, as today we do our show and we have lots to talk about that's happening right here in our own community, but there's something really important happening right now in Washington, D.C. And you might be listening to me in the car, in the kitchen, maybe around your den. I don't know where it is that is your habit to listen to this show. It might even be in the office on headphones, and you're not supposed to be. Shh, I won't tell. But here's what I'd really like you to do. I'd like you to help me today, because there's only so much multitasking I can do as I speak with you. And the hearings are getting underway in Washington, D.C. right now as we speak. So at 203-333-9422, between now and noon, I would really love it if you would pick up the phone and call and tell me what you think of them as they're happening. Right now, Representative Adam Schiff is beginning his opening monologue. We are expected to hear from William Taylor. William Taylor is not somebody who should be labeled. He is somebody who should be respected. William Taylor is a lifelong State Department employee. He has served throughout Democratic and Republican administrations with tremendous dignity. He was appointed by none other than this Trump administration to continue in the role. And he has come forward at great risk to his own reputation and his own pocketbook to speak on behalf of the still anonymous whistleblower who was so alarmed by the prospect of the president of the United States trying to extract political favor as part of formal foreign policy. So I just want you to remember what's at stake, because there are a lot of people right now trying to persuade you to think a certain way about these proceedings. I've heard people on the air say all kinds of nasty things about Adam Schiff and get away with it. I've heard all kind of people on the air say very, very nasty things about the Republicans and get away with it. And that's not what we do. That's not what I do. That's not what we do in this community of the Lisa Wexler Show. We approach things with an open mind. That's what we have to do. But let me explain what's at stake here, because it really is important. So in the past, in our journey together, if you're old enough to have lived this long, the last impeachment hearing you remember is the one from Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton was impeached based on the fact that in a private lawsuit with Paula Jones, who was somebody who accused him of completely inappropriate sexual behavior, if not outright rape, that he perjured himself. That he did so many dances about, did you have sexual relations with that woman? Well, it depends on what you believe sexual relations is. Well, what does the word is mean? And we all know how Bill Clinton danced around the head of a pin. But at stake in the end was his own sexual behavior and the perceived notion that he had demeaned the White House as a human being because of his behavior with Monica Lewinsky in the Oval Office. And that was altogether demeaning. Now, the French laughed at us. They said, what are you talking about demeaning? We have Francois Mitterrand, who is our former prime minister, and he's got a love triangle that would make the National Enquirer blush. We're not interested in the private machinations and private tomfoolery of the men who are powerful politicians. We're interested in what they do for us as figures in the world of politics itself, how they use their power. And so we had Ken Starr spend so many millions of dollars in the end on a conversation about whether or not what Bill Clinton did was important enough to throw him out of office. And it was, believe it or not, closer, I think, than people thought it would be. But in the end, he didn't get thrown out of office. He did, however, get accused. And it was a very polarized time. And there was a Republican majority in Congress, and it was very predictable about how it went. Do you remember our own Chris Shays, who represented the district now represented by Congressman Jim Himes. You remember that Chris Shays was a Republican and how he wrestled with how to vote, ultimately as a Republican voting against impeachment, which brought him against the grain of his party. But he felt in good conscience that this was not something you throw a president out of office for. Now, we've got to contrast that with what's going on here today with Donald Trump. But I think you also have to see it in the big picture of context. Because Donald Trump wants you to believe that this is about parsing a specific conversation that he had with President Zelensky. And that all you should be focused on is a transcript of a conversation, which may or may not be an accurate transcript. That's another conversation that we're going to have to hear from today. But the Democrats are arguing that really the conversation between President Trump and Zelensky is only one piece of a larger foreign policy message that was conveyed to the Ukrainian delegation that basically said, if you don't pony up information and go after what we think is a corruption involving Hunter Biden, if you don't do that, then your hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid that we have promised you in order to stave off further Russian aggression, that money is at jeopardy. And there were so many people in the State Department, including obviously the whistleblower, who felt that this was an inappropriate use of presidential power, because that's what we're talking about right now. And to focus on one specific transcript is missing the point, because presidents have all kinds of people working for them to communicate messages, and they're communicating them because of the person at the top instructing that communication. Now, what I'm hearing this morning, the latest, is that the Trump administration is prepared to throw Rudolph Giuliani under the bus. They are prepared to say that he was acting rogue, and that whatever it was that he said or did, he did not do with the authority of the president. Does that surprise you? 203-333-9422. This man has gone around the world acting as a second skin for Donald Trump, taking a battering of humiliations on television and in other places, and insisting that everything he's doing has been right and legal and ethical and moral and 100% with the full backing of the president, for whom he is some kind of personal counselor. And what I'm hearing is if what is at stake is the presidency of Donald Trump or the reputation of Rudolph Giuliani, Giuliani is going under the bus. That's where he's going. Now, I want to give you some other insight and some other information about what we're seeing today in terms of the scoops that are coming from D.C. Top Republican sources are telling Axios' Jonathan Swan that one impeachment survival strategy will be to try and distance President Trump from any Ukraine quid pro quo. The distance goes, number one, with the pushing away of Rudolph Giuliani and as much else as they can possibly do. A top Democratic aide has told Mike Allen, Mike Allen publishes an influential newsletter out of D.C., that the party's goal for the hearings is Mueller on steroids, quote, simpler crime witnessed by credible people. Mueller did exceptional work, but nobody read his 400-page report. A Democratic official saying the president abused his power to rig and fix elections in his favor. Our challenge is to keep it that simple. What kind of democracy do we want? And Republican senators, some of them are lining up to say they are too busy. They are too busy to watch these impeachment hearings, dismissing them as not important. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying, tomorrow, meaning today, I'm going to be paying attention to what we're doing in the Senate. And that alone is such a derogatory, targeted dismissal of one's colleagues. That's a shameful statement that Mitch McConnell made. The very least that he should be doing is to be watching every single bit of these hearings and admitting to it. Because he has a role to play, too. And his role is not exclusively to make sure that the Republican in office stays in office. his role as somebody who presides over the Senate going forward is to hear as much information as he possibly can to make a decision. You know, I read today the front page of the Times that was reprinted for the first date of the hearings that were held against President Nixon in the 1970s. And the stark contrast was, it was just profoundly deafening, the stark contrast. Sam Ervin was presiding over the hearings with solemnity, understated. Both Republicans and Democrats were lined up to testify. Everybody said, we're approaching this with an open mind, but this is a matter of true gravity, and we need to see what is happening with the presidency of our United States of America. It could not have been more different in tone and in collegial respect. We've come a long way in the opposite direction right now, and I think this is a good time to just stop and look at it and look at where and who we are and how you and I as Americans have been manipulated. We have been manipulated into becoming so polarized. We've been manipulated by Fox News and MSNBC and media companies that have a profit motive in mind at the end of every quarter. And do you know how many people are listening at any given time to Fox News or MSNBC in a given day? Only about 1.5 million to MSNBC and 2.5 million to Fox News. And we are a country of over 350 million people right now. So wouldn't you say that these media outlets have a disproportionate impact on what's really happening in our Congress, in our society, as they rev people up and forget about imploring all of us as Americans to try and hear the facts with an open mind? 203-333-9422 is our number. 203-333-9422 on the Lisa Wexler Show.
You can keep it. The fundamental issue raised by the impeachment inquiry into Donald J. Trump is, can we keep it? I now recognize Ranking Member Nunes for any remarks he may wish to make.
Thanks, gentlemen. In a July open hearing of this committee following publication of the Mueller report, the Democrats engaged in a last-ditch effort to convince the American people that President Trump is a Russian agent. That hearing was the pitiful finale of a three-year-long operation by the Democrats, the corrupt media, and partisan bureaucrats to overturn the results of the 2016 election.
That was a little bit of what is happening live in Washington, D.C. right now. The first bit was Adam Schiff, and then you just heard from Representative Devin Nunes, obviously drawing a dramatically different picture. So it's almost like, which planet are you entering? Which world are you entering? Let's go to James, who wants to talk with us about impeachment. James, hi, where are you from? Hello, James. Welcome to the show today. Hello. James, are you
Hello.
There?
Hello.
Hi, James. Hi, where are you from?
I'm from Derby.
Okay. Hi, James. So what do you think? And are you willing to listen to what's happening with an open mind, or is your mind already made up?
Oh, but of course. As I was telling your screener, who seems like a lovely lady, and I want to thank you, too, you know, for being a judge. I think that you're very open-minded. Anyhow, as I was telling her, I think we need to put a gate on the Congo, make the House jail and the Senate jail, because they're all treasonous. I don't care who it is. I mean, I can't find anything on Pence. But Hillary's, which scares the heck out of me, but Hillary's vice president, he was a liaison to Nicaragua in the 80s, i.e. part and parcel to the Iran-Contra affair. I think the movie Vice is correct. And does the vice president is actually running things right now, and they're CIA agent men. And I think that they mentioned Americans for Tax Reform. Oh, my God.
Anyhow, James, I just need you to be a little bit more focused in your comment today. Are you going to be watching the impeachment hearings?
No.
No.
Tell me why you're not interested.
Why?
I'll be interested in the highlights. I don't watch football either. I mean, if I'm playing or I got money on it, okay. But, well, of course, we do have money on this. But I...
All right. Well, I thank you, James, and I thank you for the call. 203-333-9422. I'm very interested in hearing from you who are watching the impeachment hearings now and who are interested in telling me what you think about them. We normally have a rule of one caller a week, and we've been getting a lot of our normal, wonderful, regular callers that have been calling in the first 15 minutes, and Christian's been saying, no, you can't speak, but I think I'll make an exception. This is a pretty big day. So I'll just ask everybody if you'd like to give us a call, 203-333-9422. So right now, Representative Devin Nunes is giving his opinion of what this is about. And from his point of view, the impeachment hearings are a frame-up. I want to go back to what he's saying. We're going to go right back.
Witness requests resulting in a horrifically one-sided process where the crucial witnesses are denied a platform if their testimony does not support the Democrats' absurd accusations. Notably, they are trying to impeach the president for inquiring into Biden's activities. Yet they refuse our request to hear from Biden himself. The whistleblower was acknowledged to have a bias against President Trump, and his attorney touted a coup against the president and called for his impeachment just weeks after the election. At a prior hearing, Democrats on this committee read out a purely fictitious rendition of the president's phone call with President Zelensky.
You're listening to live impeachment hearings happening today from Washington, D.C. That was Representative Devin Nunes, who is the ranking Republican member on the House Intelligence Committee. Adam Schiff has finished his remarks. The agenda for today is I want to hear from you. Are you watching? Are you listening? What is your feeling, your open-mindedness, your inclination to hear the facts as they're presented? Pam from Bridgeport. Hello, Pam, and welcome to the show today. Hi.
Hello, Lisa.
Hi.
Well, I'm listening, and I'm keeping an open mind. However, I have strong beliefs in the democratic process.
Pam, I think you want to. I think you may want to turn your radio down because I think that'll help. You there, Pam? You back?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay,
here,
hi,
Pam.
Hi, Pam. Okay,
Lisa.
Yes.
The reason why I'm calling is I really, honestly believe President Trump thinks he's above the law. Right after the Mueller report, all of those pages, all of that time, all of that money, that man was back at it again. He have no respect for the rule of law. He think he's above the law. And history is going to judge those Republicans and all the ones that keep defending him in all of his tomfoolery and crookedness. Going to judge them very harsh. You know, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I'm glad that you called, Pam. And I think that, you know, it's really interesting because when Richard Nixon was president, he talked about the silent majority. And he felt that when he was elected, he was representing the people that were afraid to speak up, what we today call political correctness. And he felt that he was representing the silent majority. That's why he got elected. He got very decisively elected. But I think, Pam, to some extent, what you're saying represents the silent majority, because I think there are a lot of people out there who do agree with you that President Trump's actions and behaviors appear to make it seem as if he does think he's above the law. And, you know, what's interesting about that, Pam, is that the judges are not agreeing with him. So, for example, in New York, he tried very hard to get his tax returns to not have to be disclosed in connection with a proceeding in which everybody else in the country would have had to disclose their tax returns. And the judge said, you're not above the law. They said, you're not above the law, President Trump. You may argue that you are, but you're not. And you're going to have to disclose those returns. Of course, he's appealing the decision. But, yes, I hear what you're saying, Pam.
Right away, they should have automatically disqualified him. He should not be allowed to enter the race.
Why?
Why do you say that? If you don't produce your taxes, that's an automatic disqualification.
Well,
for years...
It's not required by law. Pam. It's not required by law. No, it is not required.
You know, this guy, I don't care what they do. They just have to get him to hell out of there. This country got to heal. It just cannot continue every day with the charade of this and that and that.
Pam, let me ask you this.
She has to heal.
Let me ask you this, Pam. If President Trump steps away and Vice President Mike Pence becomes the president, are you comfortable with that in terms of the way our Constitution works?
Yes, I would be comfortable with that, but I also got to keep an eye on him, make sure that the corruptness that this guy has instilled throughout the whole Republican Party is not going to continue to fester and poison and rip apart the Constitution.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
203-333-9422. We're going to be joined in just a moment by Dr. Khalilah Brown-Dean, Professor Khalilah Brown-Dean. Professor Khalilah is somebody who is an award-winning scholar, and she's actually going to be at the Wesley and R.J. Julia Bookstore tomorrow night at 7 p.m., to talk about identity politics in the United States. And I thought we could take a brief respite from what's happening in D.C. for just a few minutes to talk to a woman whose entire career is focused on identity politics in the United States and ask her her view of how that is shaping these impeachment hearings. So stay with us on the Lisa Wexler Show, 203-333-9422.
It'll be addressed separately. Congress will not tolerate any reprisal, threat of reprisal, or attempt to retaliate against any U.S. government official for testifying before Congress, including you or any of your colleagues. If you would both rise and raise your right hand, I will begin by swearing you in. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Let the record show that the witnesses answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and please be seated.
Mr. Chairman, before we hear from the witnesses, I have a parliamentary inquiry.
The gentleman will state her parliamentary inquiry.
Mr. Chairman, when can we anticipate a response to our November 9th letter requesting certain individual witnesses to be called?
The gentlewoman should be aware that three of the witnesses the minority has requested are scheduled for next week.
Your witnesses, Mr. Chairman. What about the additional six witnesses?
The gentlewoman may inquire about additional witnesses or make a request for a vote on additional witnesses following the witness testimony.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order under HRES 660.
The gentlewoman will state her point of order.
Mr. Chairman, will you be prohibiting witnesses from answering members' questions as you have in the closed-door depositions?
As the gentlewoman should know, if she was present for the deposition.
Which I was, Mr.
Chairman. Some of them, yes.
Correct.
The only times I prevented witnesses from answering questions along with their counsel was when it was apparent that members were seeking to out the whistleblower. We will do everything necessary to protect the whistleblower's identity, and I'm disturbed to hear members of the committee who have in the past voiced strong support for whistleblower protections seek to undermine those protections by outing the whistleblower.
So what you're just hearing as it gets pretty heated from the get-go, that was Elise Stepanek, Republican from New York, who was challenging the proceedings and asking about Republican witnesses even before the testimony has even begun. George Kent is testifying side by side against William Taylor in these live proceedings going on right now. You're listening to the Lisa Wexler Show. We're going to be bringing you these proceedings throughout the show, back and forth and back and forth. We are joined now by a woman who's devoted her life to thinking and writing and lecturing about politics in America, particularly identity politics. Dr. Khalilah Brown-Dean is an author and a community leader, and she is an associate professor of political science here at Quinnipiac University. And she also is a former faculty co-coordinator of the Health Policy and Advocacy Concentration in the Frank Netter School of Medicine. She writes for a lot of different publications and actually is going to be at Wesley's R.J. Julia Bookstore talking about her latest book, Identity Politics in the United States. Hello, Professor Brown-Dean, and welcome to the show today. Hi, welcome.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
So let me ask you this. Can I call you Khalilah because it's such a pretty name?
Kalilah.
Kalilah, even better.
Yes,
Kalilah.
Thank
it's
you.
A beautiful name. What's the
thank
origin
you.
Of that name?
It's Arabic.
Oh, it's a beautiful name. Kalilah, can you please tell me, in viewing from your reference point as a scholar who spends a lot of time thinking about identity politics, how is the identity politics in America right now shaping the impeachment process in Washington, D.C.?
Everything in American politics is about identity. And what we're seeing and hearing in Washington right now is, what is the identity of America as a whole? What is the identity of political parties? How do we line up around those labels and in many ways overlook that common identity of America? What we should be doing is figuring out what is best for our country, not what is best for a particular interest or a particular politician, but what is really best, because that identity will supersede any one election or any one political party.
So let me ask you this, Kalilah. President Trump argues, and he argues this all the time, that he has helped African Americans far more than other presidents because, he argues, greater employment, a higher stock market, a better economy altogether is lifting up more people in poverty. And as a percentage of people altogether in this country, African Americans have historically suffered from poverty more than other groups. And therefore, he argues, going right to identity politics, that African Americans should vote for him. So how do you analyze this plea to the African-American community in the Trump administration?
One of the problems with that approach, Lisa, is that it undermines the tremendous diversity that exists within African-American communities like any other community.
Okay.
So when you talk about immigration, you also have to look within black communities in the U.S., particularly in places like New York and Connecticut. You have to look at the fight for voting rights in this country, the ways in which African-Americans express their religious identity. So all of us are members of multiple groups at once, and to single out a sort of monolithic, cohesive block undermines the depth of public policy in this country.
But the fact remains, and even African-American is a misnomer. There are Caribbean-American. I mean, there's, you know, all kind of
right.
black Americans.
Right.
But one must admit statistically that historically and right now, the overwhelming majority of black Americans affiliate with the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And so what I look at in the book is the why.
Okay.
So once we look at the data, what is the why? What is that relationship? Many of the same ways I look in the book about why so many Jewish Americans affiliate with the Democratic Party. Is that about values and ideals within that tradition? Is it about a history of being overlooked by particular parties? You know, is it about someone, a candidate like Al Smith, who after the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory made a direct appeal to Jewish people in New York City to say, you deserve to have workplace protections. There's a legacy to that history that is much simpler than saying, because I'm a part of this group, I automatically owe my allegiance to a political party.
And it is a little bit ironic because in the twisted way that American politics evolved, it were the Southern Democrats were the great enemy of the overwhelming majority of black Americans in the South. I mean,
right.
that's a fact. So somehow
right.
the Democratic Party of 1969 going forward convinced black Americans that they were on their side. How did they do that? How did they do that, Kalilah?
I think if we look again, I focus on policy, and I always tell my students, let's do facts, not feelings, right?
Yep.
When we look at the key policy changes, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that opened up workplace protections, not just for African Americans, but for women and really for every person in this country. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, that said it is silly to have someone guess how many jelly beans are in a jar in order to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Those procedures that were used to keep blacks out in the South originated in the North to keep white ethnic immigrants from being able to express the full benefits of citizenship. So when a party can speak to your very right to live, to earn, and to learn, then you are able to cultivate that support over time. And just as the Democratic Party today is not the Democratic Party of the 50s, the Republican Party of today is not the Republican Party of the 40s.
Do you think that President Trump is being effective in his appeal to elements of the black community?
I think he has certainly appealed to particular elements of Black communities. You know, Black communities have long had a morally conservative strain, often because of the role of religion within those communities. And so he is able to speak to that. And what I think we all have to do is to say that, yes, African Americans are Republicans. African Americans are conservative. African Americans are supportive of President Trump. And we shouldn't try to diminish that, just as we can also say there were white women who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton simply because she was the first woman to ascend to that candidacy.
It's 10:41. We're chatting with Professor Kalila Brown-Dean, who has written a book called Identity Politics in the U.S., and we'll be talking about that book tomorrow night at 7 p.m. in Middletown at the Wesley and R.J. Julia bookstore, where you can meet her and really have an in-depth conversation. I would just like to ask you this, Kalila, if I may. What is your view as a scholar, as a professor, on affirmative action and identity politics? How is that interplay happening now? And what do you foresee in the next 10 years in terms of policymaking, affirmative action?
Sure. I think too often people hear the term affirmative action and they automatically think race. Affirmative action happens in corporate boardrooms where trustees are deciding, why does our C-suite not have women? Mm-hmm. And what kind of steps can we take to increase and build the pipeline? Affirmative action was never meant to say we're going to have an unqualified person simply because of their identity. It is when we line up resumes or when we line up college applications, what is the student body we want? What is the workplace that we want? And again, to understand, just because you look like me does not mean we have the same views. So with the U.S. Supreme Court issuing key decisions on affirmative action in education, with corporate entities saying, how do we represent our shareholders and our consumers so that we can stay competitive and relevant, I think that conversation will begin to shift.
But we have written into the federal code this idea of an MBE, a minority business enterprise. And if one qualifies for it, whether because of one's gender status or racial status, you do get a set aside, so to speak. There has to be a certain amount of business allocated to firms with that composition. I guess I'm wondering, based on your research and your own view of things, do you think that those policies will inevitably decline, or will they stay part of our statute?
I think that the hope is that the need for those kinds of policies will go away, just as the hope was that in 1965, we would no longer need to have these protections of voting rights. And if those policies are to go away, which I hope that they will, it will be contingent on us as members of this country, as voters, as business owners, as entrepreneurs, to take the kind of steps so that those things are no longer necessary. We're not there yet, but I certainly hope we'll get there.
And Professor, one last question for you. I'm curious, in your worldview and your research, where do you put a figure like Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, who was a Black man who was very specifically chosen to fill the seat of Thurgood Marshall, who was married to a white woman who has publicly been very strongly affiliated with many right-wing conservative groups, and who will go down in history as one of the most conservative justices ever in terms of restriction of federal power as opposed to expansion of federal power on a lot of issues that have been very important to the Black community. So how does Clarence Thomas, how does he view his identity in the world of identity politics?
I think Clarence Thomas views his identity as an American, and I think that is fine. I talk in the book about the distinction between how you identify yourself and how society identifies you. Mm. But to step into a space like the U.S. Supreme Court, which is such an amazing institution to hold and protect the American people, you have to understand how you show up in that space and what the expectation is. So I think rather than people condemning a Clarence Thomas, I think people have to understand the views that he represents. And of course, he is not the only one who shares those perspectives or those life experience. What does it mean that in 2019, we have still only had two African-American members of that august judicial body?
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Your talk tomorrow at Wesleyan, I hope it's a great success. And the book is Identity Politics. And we invite you back on the show, Professor Kalila Brown-Dean, Identity Politics in the U.S. You can go meet her, see her, sign the book, buy the book at Wesleyan R.J. Julia Bookstore tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. in Middletown. Thank you very much. And now I'm going to go back to, you know, the program, the live stuff that's going on, Kalila. Thanks for coming on the show today. It is just a couple of, it's a quarter of 11. We're going to hear a little bit, and then we're going to take some messages. So we're turning back now. This is George Kent, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, giving some testimony before the committee.
Last 5 years, even though much remains to be done. And by all of us, I mean those of us in the legislative and the executive branches, in both parties, the interagency community working out of our embassy in Kyiv, with Ukrainians in government, the military, and civil society, and our transatlantic allies and partners. We cannot allow our resolve to waver, since too much is at stake, not just for Ukraine and the future of European security, but for the national interests of the United States, broadly defined. My prior deposition covered a lot of ground over 10 hours. Here are the main 10 themes for my testimony. I outlined my experience with longstanding U.S. interest in supporting anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. This work gave me a front row.
We'll be right back.
In 2019, I became increasingly aware of an effort by Rudy Giuliani and others, including his associates Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, to run a campaign to smear Ambassador Yovanovitch and other officials at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. The chief agitators on the Ukrainian side of this effort were some of those same corrupt former prosecutors I had encountered, particularly Yuri Lutsenko and Viktor Shokin. They were now peddling false information in order to extract revenge against those who had exposed their misconduct, including U.S. diplomats, Ukrainian anti-corruption officials, and reform-minded civil society groups in Ukraine. During the late spring and summer of 2019, I became alarmed as those efforts bore fruit. They led to the ouster of Ambassador Yovanovitch and hampered U.S. efforts to establish rapport with the new Zelensky administration in Ukraine. In mid-August, it became clear to me that Giuliani's efforts to gin up politically motivated investigations were now infecting U.S. engagement with Ukraine, leveraging President Zelensky's desire for a White House meeting. There are and always have been conditionality placed on our sovereign loan guarantees for Ukraine. Conditions include anti-corruption reforms, as well as meeting larger stability goals and social safety nets. The International Monetary Fund does the same thing. Congress and the executive branch work together to put conditionality on some security assistance in the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. Regarding my testimony today, I will do my best to answer your questions, questions that will involve issues, conversations, and documents that span a number of years. I may be limited by three considerations. First, the State Department has collected all materials in response to the September 27th subpoena that may contain facts relevant to my testimony. I have no such documents or materials with me today. I will thus do my best to answer as accurately, completely, and truthfully as I can to the best of my recollection. Second, as this committee knows,
you're listening to George Kent. He's testifying, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, right now live. As we go back and forth to the live testimony, as the impeachment hearings begin in Washington, D.C., the hearing is being led by Adam Schiff, and he is having a, I would say, a very combative. In other words, the Democrats and Republicans on the committee are clearly at odds with each other. The Republicans are challenging much of this hearing from the get-go. They're coming out in full force. They are challenging their right to have called the witnesses that they want to call, their right to question the witnesses that they want to question. But George Kent has been testifying this morning that essentially there was a plot in Ukraine to undermine Ms. Yovanovitch, who was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and that with the when the other American State Department employees found out about it, they tried very hard to stop it. And so we're going to hear a lot about, and a lot of these names are not easy to remember, a lot of these names are not easy to place. So much of intrigue is called intrigue because it's complicated. But we're going to be doing our best as we go back and forth through this show until noon to get you the real-life scoop on what's happening in D.C. because this is a big deal. 203-333-9422. And what I want to ask you today, as you're watching it, as you're listening to it, what are the thoughts going through your mind? Do you believe that this is crippled because it is so polarized from the get-go? That without the according of legitimacy from the party, from one political party to another, that no matter what the results is, it looks so political, it looks so partisan, it can't possibly be the will of the people. You know, we've had guests on this show, some of them in very high offices, who have alluded to the fact that they think there is the beginnings of a civil war going on in this country. And I always like to poo-poo it because I'm such a conciliatory person. I'm a Rodney King, can't we all get along kind of a gal, that I don't really like to think about the idea that people could be so angry at each other that it could possibly ever go to the streets. When I hear war, I think about warfare. But, you know, when I have to look dispassionately at what's happening in Congress, if that's a symptom and symbol of how far apart we are, if the polls are any true indication of how few people left have made up their mind, I think we are in trouble. I think we are in trouble in every facet of America. And if I can digress for just a little bit, I watched a movie the other day on the plane called Booksmart, which starred Beanie Feldstein and a bunch of other people. And it's sort of like today's Clueless. In other words, Clueless, which I loved. It was a charming comedy of years ago, starring Alicia Silverman, I think, and so many others, and Paul Rudd, and all these wonderful actors and people that went on to great acclaim, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and so many others. Or am I confusing that with 10 Things I Hate About You? No, Clueless. Clueless is the one with Paul Rudd and Alicia Silverman. Anyway, Alicia Silverstone. And it was such a charming movie, and it didn't have any cursing, and the soundtrack was just innocent and lovely, and it had a lot to say about an L.A. scene of high school kids at that time, led by Cher, the protagonist Cher. And the update to that movie is this very vulgar, very disturbingly coarse, sad movie of what it must be like to go to high school today in L.A. called Booksmart. And it's about a girl who gets into Yale, but she's very perturbed to find out that other people have gotten into Yale, but they haven't done what she's done, which is keep her nose clean and not do drugs and not do parties and just study all the time. So on the last night before graduation, she decides to go to the party where all the cool kids are. And it's her experience of that night that ends up being the movie. And it's got a lot of lesbian sex, very graphic lesbian sex. It's got a lot of very, very coarse language between and among young people. It's got a soundtrack that ought to be edited out every third word for the filth. And it was profoundly disturbing to me. Because I thought to myself, is this the community now that our kids are really growing up in? Has it devolved into being, you know, it doesn't need to be 1950s pom-pom cheerleaders to have to be perfect and wonderful. There is a continuum. And I wonder if we can ever go back. We have an astounding rate of suicide among young people. We have therapists and psychologists saying that they have never before seen a generation so fragile. So fragile, so emotionally fragile. The social media and the meanness that goes on in our society, are we ever going to get the genie back in the bottle? Are we ever going to go back to a Motown sound and to self-censorship and self-restraint in the media? We exercise that every day on this show, that's for sure, and you're my partner in that. But it seems that we're a vanishing phenomenon. Go see the movie Booksmart. You tell me what you think it's about. 203-333-9422. We're going to go back to the hearings before the top of the hour, 11 o'clock. And in the next hour, we're going to encourage your thoughts and your views on the impeachment hearings against Donald Trump as they begin today. We have a You Be the Judge case coming up at 11:30, and I ask you to play. Stay tuned. We're going right now to Ambassador William Taylor, acting U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and then we'll get to top of the hour news.
That drove that president to flee to Russia in February 2014, but not before his forces killed 100 Ukrainian protesters in central Kyiv. Days later, Mr. Putin invaded Crimea, holding a sham referendum at the point of Russian army rifles. The Russians absurdly claimed that 97% voted to join Russia. In early April, Putin sent his army and security forces into southeastern Ukraine to generate illegal armed formations and puppet governments in what we know as Donbas. You can see this on the map in the right-hand portion, in the eastern portion of the country. 14,000 Ukrainians have died in the war in Donbas, and more die each week. In July 2014, these Russian-led forces in Donbas shot down a civilian airliner en route from Amsterdam to Malaysia, killing all 298 people on board. We, the Europeans, and most of the West impose economic sanctions and kick the Russians out of the G8. Beginning in 2014, we and NATO began to provide military assistance to Ukraine's armed forces in the form of training, advice, military equipment, and weapons. It is this security assistance that is at the heart of the controversy that we are discussing today. The pro-Russian president, who was run out of Kyiv in 2014, had let the Russian armed forces deteriorate to the point of ruin. In response to the Russian invasion, the new Ukrainian authorities, with an amazing outpouring of support from regular Ukrainian people, rebuilt the army, nearly from scratch, spending more than 5% of Ukrainian GDP on defense since the war started. The whole Ukrainian nation fiercely responded.